Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the On Air podcast. So we are kind of back in our comfort zone this week, I think, of taking a tiny little story that's happened and spinning it out into a long discussion that's only vaguely connected to the original thing we were supposed to be discussing. So the kernel of an actual current affairs related story, which has happened this week, which is sort of the inspiration for the episode, is the announcement of a royal divorce. Prince Nicolaos of Greece and his wife, Princess Tatiana, have announced that they are divorcing after 14 years of marriage. He's the son of King Constantine, and Tatiana was his wife for 14 years. She's Venezuelan. They have no children together, so should hopefully be a relatively straightforward divorce. But yeah, so they announced their divorce, and we're just going to talk about it very briefly. I have to say, I was really surprised.
Yes. I know we've been talking about we wanted a divorce that we didn't particularly care about because it would give us a nice topic. But yeah, this one kind of, it was less of a, oh, that's exciting, more of a, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, so it's sometimes when a royal couple divorces, like there will have been hints about it in the press, so they will have maybe lived separate lives for a while. And so I don't know if it's just because I don't follow the Greek royal family, you know, but either way, I think I was really surprised. Just, I think, like, we saw them last that I know of in February at King Constantine's Thanksgiving memorial thing, which is the event that William missed that kicked off all of the conspiracy theory overdrive, in case that people had forgotten. And they went to that event and they were like linking arms, arrived together, nothing amiss. I'm not like sad, because it doesn't really impact me at all. But there's a little bit of like, oh, that's a shame, because I quite liked them.
Yeah. I think, you know, I don't particularly follow any of the Greek royals, but if I had a favourite, it was Princess Tatiana. And I was like, oh, damn it, now she's not even a royal. No, she wasn't even a royal in the first place because they were the Greek royals. But still, I was like, okay, I've got no one left.
Yeah, I know. They were the only members of the Greek royal family that I actually liked. They lived in Greece for a long time. They were learning the language. They were doing charity work in Greece. They genuinely seemed to really love Greece as a country and kind of respect their place in Greek society of like, they're not royals anymore.
Yes, I'm not particularly a big fan of Pavlos and Marie Chantal. And I don't really know the other Greek siblings. So I was like, well, sorry, Greek royal family, unless Constantine keeps doing miraculous appearances from beyond the grave, you're just falling off my radar.
Yeah.
And I think their timing was really inconvenient because we just decided what we were going to do in the podcast. And then you were like, ooh, wait.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Yes. Yeah. So do you want to read the statement that they actually released then?
So the statement they released, which they released on the 19th of April, said, "We wish to inform you of a significant and heartfelt decision made by their Royal Highnesses, Prince Nicolaos and Princess Tatiana. After 14 years of marriage, they have chosen to amicably dissolve their union. This decision was reached with great care and mutual respect, reflecting the depth of their appreciation for one another and the moments they have shared. Their future interactions will continue to be guided by these same principles of respect and understanding as they transition into a relationship rooted in a strong friendship. They will continue to live and build their lives in Greece, a place they both call home. The family will always support them."
They're friends. That's what we get loud and clear. Big friends. No fighting. Everyone's friends. Conscious uncoupling.
Yeah, very much conscious uncoupling.
Yes. But I think we don't really know very much about the detail, which is why we are doing a larger topic. We haven't done too many royal divorce announcements since we started. So, you know, it's worth talking about, but not worth, we can't do an hour and a half on that one statement, I don't think. I mean, maybe we could. We're impressive at dragging things out, but
yeah, we can manage to drag it out, I think, for a fair chunk of time, but a lot of it would just be us going, I'm not entirely sure what would happen, but this could possibly happen. You never know. I think our episode on the Greek royal family is one of my favourite episodes we've ever done. So whenever I get a chance to research Greek stuff, I'm like, yes, more monkey assassins, please.
episode 51, which is our one all about the Greek royal family, and it does feature a monkey assassin.
A brilliant monkey assassin.
So I think, as I say, because we don't know a huge deal about what's going on, and I know nothing about Greek divorce legislation, we thought that we would use it to discuss the topic of royal divorces a bit more broadly.
So, we thought we would start by talking about kind of the history of divorce. Way back when, divorce and marriage did not exist in the same way we think about it today. But that also meant there were a lot more what we would call divorce today, where people would just kind of be like, yeah, we've fallen out, we will no longer be together. And it was just very much viewed as a normal thing to do. And then the Romans popped up and decided they were going to spread some Christian messages around the world. And everything changed because the church suddenly became this overpowering force in most of the world, particularly the Western world. And one of the church's sacraments is marriage. So it went from being this kind of convenient way to produce offspring to being a religious sacrament, and it could not be broken.
So couples could get a divorce, but a divorce was more like a kind of separation of affairs. Like you would live in different houses, the woman might get her fortune back, but your matrimonial obligations to each other didn't end. So you couldn't remarry. What you would generally get instead was what is called an annulment. So an annulment is different from a divorce because in an annulment, it says that the marriage was never legally valid and never should have happened. And it's kind of like the church just goes, yep, nope, shouldn't have happened. So it didn't happen. That's it. And that means that you can remarry because, in the eyes of the church, you were never married the first time around. So there's nothing wrong with remarrying. And so back then, you might have had things like you weren't mentally capable. It could be that you were already engaged to somebody else. And the definition of being engaged to somebody was quite different back then as well. So it could just be, your families had discussed getting married, or it violated some biblical rule.
Or if you never consummated your
If you never
marriage.
consummated the marriage, that's a big one as well. Yes. So there's lots of different grounds for a way you can get when you can get an annulment. We have this idea, this is where we get into Henry VIII, because we have this idea that like Henry VIII broke away from the Catholic Church so that he could get a divorce. And then after that, loads of people getting divorces left, right, and centre. That really didn't happen at all. So actually, Henry VIII never got divorced, he got annulments. Even after they broke away from the Church of Rome, after the Reformation, at least in England, but I think it was the same in other countries as well, the divorces and annulments and things were still handled by the church. They were just handled by the Church of England rather than by the Pope.
He only broke away from the church, really, because he wanted to remarry.
Yes, and they wouldn't grant him an annulment.
Yes, yeah, so he was like, I'll just do it myself, it's fine. I will be my own head of the church. So your average, person, especially, your not aristocracy royalty people, were not popping into the local church on the weekend and being like, yeah, can we get a divorce, please? Like, they were expensive things to do. So even if your local vicar was a very nice man who was happy to grant you a divorce, it would have cost you an absolute fortune, particularly in those days when everything was like a potato for a cow. I don't know how much money worked in the olden days.
I'm pretty sure they had money in the 1600s, but let's go with the potato and cow analogy.
As time started to go by, when there was the beginnings of a kind of separation between church and state, Parliament kind of could grant divorces. So it could say, yeah, we not the church will end your marriage through an act of parliament. But that was very much also only available to kind of the richest highbrow members of society, because most people couldn't just pop into the Houses of Parliament and ask for a divorce.
Something that happened across Europe, we saw the Enlightenment, and I suppose connected to that, we saw revolutions. And so in the Enlightenment, they started to think maybe marriage should be about love. And it was this groundbreaking idea because I'm actually interesting. I'm reading a book about women in the 1600s right now. Even women felt like you shouldn't marry somebody who you love because then you're going to be ruled by your heart and not by your head. You'll make silly decisions. You might jeopardize your money. You might jeopardize your, you might end up marrying somebody who's a cad and goes off and cheats on you with everybody. And so people started to think about, incompatibility, not being compatible with your spouse anymore, should be a good enough reason for you to separate because you're no longer in love with that person. It shouldn't have to be just be that they cheated on you or something else. It should be enough to be able to get a divorce just because you don't love someone. which went against the church's teaching. And as you said, this separation of church and state that came about with a lot of these revolutions and Napoleon and that kind of thing was this shift of legal matters should be decided by the people, essentially. And that eventually kind of culminated. You start seeing the first civil divorce laws being introduced in most European monarchies and most European countries in kind of the 19th century, which is actually later than I thought.
Yeah, I think in my head, people started to get kind of divorced in the, you know, like casually in the 1600s, kind of, and then more and more and more. And then by the time we get to Queen Victoria, they were just casually getting divorced. But, you know, I looked back for the first case of divorce law in the UK, and it was in 1857, which is far later than I was expecting.
Even at that time, it was still expensive. So it still wasn't something that was accessible to everybody necessarily up until really the 20th century when people started to have access to, you know, just their normal court. It could be decided in their local court fairly cheaply.
Yeah, and it was also so intrinsically linked with like the rights of women in society.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the first few sort of waves of civil divorce law were very much linked, it was very much essentially men could get divorced and then women could get divorced in very special circumstances. They were often public viewing, so it would allow for people to kind of see all the dirty laundry, which is not really what you want to happen in a society which at the time was very much based on your reputation. But then when rights of women began to shift in the early 20th century, then divorce laws started to kind of reform and adapt and begin to sort of reduce the differences in what a man had to prove and a woman had to prove to get divorced.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that the church has no role in divorces in modern royalty. It's rare for the church to have to be involved, but there are still some Catholic monarchies and there are still some limited situations where this actually matters. So the big example is Princess Caroline of Monaco, who had to get an annulment from her first husband, Philippe Jeannot, from Pope John Paul II himself. They took ages to decide, to the extent that in the interim between them, her filing and them deciding that she could get an annulment, she remarried, had three children, and her second husband died. So a lot, she did a lot. And then they granted it. And the only reason she did that was because she wanted her three children to be legitimized, because there's always concerns in Monaco about succession and about there not being enough people in the line of succession. They've had several succession crises. So she wanted to make sure that her children were in the line of succession, which they wouldn't have been in the eyes of the Catholic Church anyway, otherwise, because she would have just got a divorce from Philippe. And so her marriage to Stefano Casaraghi would have been legally invalid.
Still today in the Catholic Church, if you divorce, you can't remarry within the church. So if you look at different Catholic monarchies, quite often, I'm thinking particularly in Spain, you know, there have been two divorces in sort of recent Spanish history, and neither of them have remarried. Some countries where the head of state is also the head of that kind of individual religion, if the rules around succession rely on the monarch's permission, that often can sort of cause issues. So I know, you know, if we think about Princess Anne's first marriage, when she got divorced from Mark Phillips and remarried Tim, she had to remarry in Scotland because the Church of England didn't allow remarriage, even though her mum was the head of the Church of England, you know.
Marriage isn't a sacrament in the Church of Scotland. But, you know, there still is this social stigma, and there still was for, you know, even after divorce was something that was commonly available. So, you know, we do know for a fact that there were divorced people weren't invited to certain events at Buckingham Palace. They weren't allowed to go into the Queen's reign. And as we talked about in our episode the week before, the Queen didn't go to Charles's civil ceremony for his second marriage. Although divorce now is a legal thing, and it's quite different in many ways from how it was in sort of the Reformation era, there is still sometimes this sort of influence that the church can have, or that societal attitudes that are based in religious principles can have.
I think particularly people who would often in other sort of aspects of their life view themselves as very kind of liberal have this real kind of stigma about divorcees, and they're like, oh, well, she's divorced, so, particularly female divorcees. Never seems to see it applied to men as much.
No.
But you know, Tizia, Camilla, Megan, you know, they're all divorced, they've all remarried, and a lot of the criticism they get is because they are a divorced person rather than through, you know, because of any actions they've done.
Well, it always surprises me, and I don't know why it does surprise me, it shouldn't, but it always surprises me how puritanical some royal watchers are. So when I was researching this, I did find somebody who was like, see, you know, divorce is what happens when you allow royals to marry commoners instead of marrying other royals. Back when they all married other royals, nobody ever got divorced. And it was like, yeah, but that was because for a long time, it was illegal. And then when it wasn't illegal, it was incredibly difficult to get. And, you know, there was huge social stigma involved in it. So people just lived together miserably or had affairs and separated. Like, it's not some sort of moral failing on the part of commoners that we just can't hack it in a royal marriage and it's all our fault. I'm going to talk about what's happened in other previous divorces and kind of go through some of the key areas. So I think one of the main areas that we have to discuss is titles. And different royal families all seem to handle things quite differently. But we thought we'd go through the kind of main attitudes or approaches that different royal families have. So the first sort of main category, I would say, is royals who have their titles removed entirely. One example is Spain. Infanta Elena, the daughter of King Juan Carlos and Queen Sofia, divorced her husband Jamie in 2010, her husband. Now, Sofia was given the title of Duchess of Lugo in her own right. So that is a title that she holds by herself. When they were married, Jamie was known as the Duke of Lugo as her husband. And when they divorced in 2010, it was confirmed that he would from then on be no longer able to use the ducal title because he was no longer her consort.
So another example of a royal who completely lost their title is Tessie Anthony, the old Princess Tessie of Luxembourg, who is always fun to research because she's so dramatic about everything. So Tessie is a really interesting case because when she married Prince Louis back in 2006, she wasn't given any titles because they had had a child out of wedlock. And then in 2009, the Grand Duke gave Tessie and her children titles, so she became then Princess of Luxembourg. And then when they got divorced in 2019, part of the divorce, due to the rules in Luxembourg, were that she kind of lost all her titles. So she lost the HRH, she lost the Princess of Luxembourg title straight away, pretty much. She then took them to court.
She tried to get a British court to force them to give her the title of princess back.
Yeah, so that didn't go down well for her. And she currently does not have a title. But obviously her children have kept their titles. So they didn't take away from all of them, just Tessie.
And she does still sometimes use the last name de Nassau. Yeah, so that is because of... That was very clear. She was never going to win that case in the British court, partly because the British court can't force Luxembourg to do whatever they, you know, to do anything, really. that makes no sense. But also because this wasn't something that was just done to punish Tessie. There was a decree, the Grand Ducal Decree in 1995, that said that titles are lost after a legal separation, a divorce, or if a widow remarries. I guess I think my view on titles is that the prince and princess or all those sorts of things, they don't actually mean anything anymore. So whether somebody has them or not, I don't really care. But I do think it's just better if you have sort of standardized rules for everybody, because then you avoid situations. This isn't related to divorce, but like Queen Margrethe stripping her some of her grandchildren of their titles went down very, very badly and was, you know, not a good look. And if you do that in a case of a divorce, I think it just can seem a bit harsh and personal. So yes, if you want to remove titles, I think that makes perfect sense because they don't have the position anymore. But I prefer it if it's like all nice and regulated.
Yeah, no emotion involved.
Yes. So the second category that I think I identified was that there is a change, but they still have some kind of title. So it's generally that they are given a lesser version of what of something that they had before. So some examples of this happening, we have Queen Hussein, nope, King Hussein of Jordan's first wife Dina was Queen Dina of Jordan. And then after they divorced, she was given the title of princess. So that is lesser than queen, but there are a few that I would say are very famous examples of this happening. One of those is Alexandra in Denmark. So she was Princess Alexandra. She was married to Prince Joachim, the son of Queen Margrethe. And in 2004, they got divorced. And she was extremely popular in Denmark. And so she went from Her Royal Highness, Princess Alexandra of Denmark, to Her Highness, Princess Alexandra, Countess of Frederiksberg. And then when she got married, she became Her Excellency Alexandra, Countess of Frederiksberg.
Yes.
So they basically created something new for her. Frederiksborg is a palace, so it's kind of, it's kind of like creating Edward as the Duke of Windsor. It's like a personal title that has a connection to her.
Yes. Which is also the way Britain likes to adapt their divorcee titles. So probably the two most famous ones are Diana and Sarah Ferguson, because when they were married, Diana was Her Royal Highness the Princess of Wales, and Sarah Ferguson was Her Royal Highness the Duchess of York. And then when they got divorced, they lost the HRH and the and became Diana Princess of Wales and Sarah Duchess of York. If Sarah does go on to remarry, and the person she remarries is not Andrew, she will u lose the Duchess of York title entirely, and she'll just be Mrs. Sarah, whoever. See, if Andrew remarries, his new wife would be the Duchess of York, because the it's not their title, it's not Diana's title or Sarah's title, they're just kind of subsidiaries of their husbands.
If you understand how titles work, you can read a title. It's like clues. It's like it's a code almost that's telling you something about the individual. And so they lost the HRH to signify that they were no longer sort of within the royal family as such. They also lost the because the is a definite article. So the example I gave on Tumblr was like if somebody says, "Can you pass a sponge?" then that could be any sponge. But if somebody says, "Can you pass the sponge?" that implies that there's only one sponge or that they are referring to one specific sponge. I don't know why I always use sponges as example, because I don't think this really happens very often that people are asked to pass each other sponges, but it's the one that always comes to mind. And it's a similar thing. So they lost the. And so yeah, you can see that, when they announced that this was how women were going to be titled after a divorce, it kind of it's it, if you know the code, you can read, oh well, I can see where they've changed and why that change has been made. It's very logical, actually. And the Queen, obviously, there hadn't been a huge number of divorces where the woman didn't have like a princess title in her own right. So we had like Princess Margaret. There hadn't been divorces in this sort of way for a while. And so the Queen sort of created a rule. And so this would apply in future circumstances, unless there was a change by letters patent. The rule that happened for Diana and Sarah would also happen in the case of future royal divorces as well. But the last sort of category is the rarest, I would say, which is keeping the title exactly as it is. And I think that historically that happened quite a lot because there was a lot of, it was much more informal, the titles that people had. They were also royals in their own right. And so they would go from being Princess Jane to Princess Jane after the divorce. And nobody really paid much attention to that sort of secondary bit that happened. They were just Princess Jane. So it didn't really, a lot of the time people's titles didn't change. But I would say in the modern era, it's much less common. A modern example that I thought of was Princess Munna of Jordan. So she is the mother of the current King of Jordan, King Abdullah, and she was married to his father, King Hussein. And I mentioned earlier Queen Dina, who was also married to King Hussein. Now, she was known as Queen Dina, and then after the divorce, she was downgraded to princess. Munna was never known as queen. She was always Princess Munna. When they divorced, she already had the lower title that was the same as what Dina had been given when she divorced. So there was nothing to really downgrade it to. They didn't have like a system of aristocracy or anything that they could give her a countess title. And so she just kept her title as it was. So she has remained, she is still Princess Munna today. She's still alive.
Yes. So the example that I came up with was Princess Margaret's ex-husband, Anthony Armstrong Jones, because way back in the 50s, 60s, when they got together and got married, you kind of have to remember, there weren't very many royals. And the Queen didn't want to make Andrew a prince because Andrew, who's Andrew? Antony, a prince, because then Antony would essentially have outranked Margaret. But also, it seemed wrong for Princess Margaret to be going around with your average, commoner with no title. So he was given the title of the Earl of Snowdon and the subsidiary title of Viscount Linley. So when he divorced Margaret, when they got divorced in the 70s in 1978, he didn't have a princely title or a HRH in the first place. But because the Earl of Snowdon title was created for him to be passed down to his male heirs, the Queen couldn't take that away from him. So he kept his title exactly as it had been when he was married, right up until when he died a few years ago.
The way that titles often work is that you're getting it because you're married to somebody. So Kate isn't Princess of Wales in her own right. She's got it because of her marriage to William. Most examples of titles after divorce, there is some level of change. It's because you got that title in the first place only through virtue of your marriage. So the rare exceptions often are because it was your title in the first place.
And I think in this kind of entire title discussion, when I went through the current, I predominantly focused on the European monarchies, but when I looked at them, most of the divorces, and oddly for some reason, most of the royals that have been relevant for the last 100 years were female-born royals who married men. And often in those circumstances, the male marrying in chooses not to have a title because it would be a lesser title than his wife's. So a lot of the cases where there have been divorces, the man didn't have a title in the first place to sort of get rid of. Whereas for the women, they have had titles that have then changed. So it's a weird one because there's a discrepancy, but it's not because of any kind of gender. It's just because men don't have titles in the first place.
The next big topic is probably one of the biggest topics in divorce generally, I think. Money. Money is a lot more loose. There are not the same sort of rules and laws that we can point to and say, this is what happens in this country. And we know that because it's written down in this decree. I think if you were somebody who married into a royal family, but you were not a working royal and your partner wasn't a working royal, then your financial matters, even though you are royal, are pretty much the same as any couple who are going through a divorce. We have this perception, perhaps, that if you are divorcing a royal, you're going to get like a huge pay packet. And sometimes you do, but often royals are not actually as rich as we think they are. So they might be like the child of somebody who is very, very rich, or the grandchild of somebody who is very, very rich, but they themselves are not actually that wealthy, especially not compared to people in their social circle. I think quite a lot of the examples of where a royal couple is split, where they're not state funded, the person that they married who was not a royal actually is wealthier than the royal. And so, for example, you have Jamie and Elena again. We believe that actually, after they divorced, Jamie paid child support and maintenance and things to Elena because he made a lot more money than her when they split up. Which is, even though he was not the royal one.
In the media just before their divorce, it's Jamie being like, I don't care about money. Like, I've got the money. Like, I don't care. The other example in that section would be, again, Tessie and Louis. Louis is, was at that point, just, what, I see, the third of the Luxembourg children. And he has was in the army and has a few jobs, whereas Tessie also was in the army. And then she went on to be quite a successful, like a speaker, some weird psychotherapist job. And it got to the point where, helpfully, they did give us exact numbers. So the Tessie had asked for £1.5 million lump sum to buy a family home and a car. And then the judge said, well, actually, based on all of the financial evidence we've got, that's not fair. So you can keep the house. But the judge ordered Louis to pay £4,000 per child per year, which is a tiny, tiny figure. It's minuscule. I think the actual court ruling referred to it as a nominal sum.
Yes, so we know that the Grand Duke and Grand Duchess paid for like the kids' school and healthcare and all of that kind of thing. And it did say that it could change. So if Louis suddenly comes into loads of money or suddenly does very successfully in his business or whatever and has more money, then he can give her more money and it would be, you know, changed at that point in time. But it was a very small, I think more less than a lot of couples, ordinary couples who have no royal connections would get. And Tessie was very angry about this because she said it was ridiculous. Like his father is extremely, you know, the Duke, Grand Duke of Luxembourg is extremely wealthy. But the court basically was like, but his parents' money is not his money. If these couples who are not state funded and just sort of have to hash it out like any ordinary couple, it often doesn't go the way that you expect. And so if you're marrying somebody who is not a working royal because you think that you're going to get a quick payday, you may be wrong.
Try again.
Try again. I think it's because a lot of the time they're marrying people who are in the same social circle as them. In the case of like Elena and Jamie, Jamie was from his a noble family in his own right. Royals don't tend to hang out with like common folk like us. And so often they will end up marrying somebody who is wealthier than them. But I suppose the other category is then the couples who are state funded. The most royals will lose some form of state funding. However, there are exceptions. And I think the most high profile example of a royal who did not lose public funding was Alexandra in Denmark. But she was basically given a significant annual allowance under the civil list for life. She chose to give it up when her sons turned 18 because there was a bit of criticism about her still getting that money. The times had changed. But at the time of the divorce, the government said, yep, we're going to give you an annual allowance, a decent annual allowance every year for the rest of your life, which is very rare.
Not being a working royal, and just getting it was 2.1 million krona, which is about 1.5 million pounds a year for the rest of your life, was very appealing to me. And I know Alexandra gave up, so she was raising some children and now is not getting all that money, but royals get the money they do predominantly because they have to, look good and have nice houses and pay for staff, whereas Alexandra didn't actually need to do any of that. So I like to imagine she was putting a lot aside into savings and is now living very comfortably. I would do personally. She's probably the person that came out of royal divorce, the only one thinking, you know what, I've really struck gold here.
Yeah, really did. Yeah. I think for, but I think hers is an unusual situation. For, I would say for most royals who had spent some time being publicly funded, they don't continue to get state funding after the divorce because they're not doing the job. But that doesn't mean they're completely cut adrift. Usually, like with most divorces, there is some sort of financial settlement. There's a recognition that you're going from a situation where your finances were completely taken care of for the rest of your life to suddenly having that taken away from you overnight, pretty much. And so they do tend to get the more generous financial packages when they're in this category. So, for example, I think the two most high profile examples are Sarah Ferguson and Diana.
So, Sarah Ferguson was again very helpful. She liked to tell us things. So, when they divorced, she loudly announced that she'd received a mere £15,000 a year settlement, which was then quite quickly proven not to be true. And it was instead found out that she was given £350,000 in cash, which just seems dodgy, but okay. £500,000 to buy a house so she could live near. The Duke of York, and they could co-parent their children, and as well as that, a monthly allowance, which is a fair bit. I could do with £500,000 to buy a house personally, but it was, and also the monthly allowance didn't have an end point, so it wasn't a monthly allowance until your children are grown up. It was a monthly allowance until you die, and that maybe that is the £15,000, but I don't know because that bit was a bit hidden from me. But I do like how Sarah looked at all these numbers and went, yeah, £15,000 a year, that's all I get.
With Tessie and Louis, we got the whole shebang released and we all got to view it. I read the divorce papers and everything. With like the British royals, it's often sort of we don't actually know 100% for definite what they got. Diana, we believe, received significantly more than Sarah did, perhaps reflecting the fact that Charles was independently wealthy because he had his own source of income, whereas Andrew did not. So the figure that I read was that she got 17 million as a lump sum.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, which is almost 33 million now. So I think generally speaking, I don't think that money is actually handled drastically differently for most royal couples to how most non-royal couples will handle it. It's still, you have to hash out the details of a settlement. I think it's a general principle of divorce courts that, like, if you were a stay-at-home mother for 20 years while your husband went to work, it shouldn't be the case that when you divorce, she's left with nothing. Like, she still contributed to the household. She raised his kids so that he could go to work and make loads of money. And she's used to a certain level of lifestyle that she's had for 20 years. And so courts take that into consideration and try to make sure that it's kind of fair, at least in the UK, they do anyway. And that's not really any different for royals. Like, if you're somebody who didn't have much wealth marrying a royal, and you've had a certain sort of lifestyle, you've been sort of financially supported by the state, they don't want you to just sort of suddenly be cut off. And that's the way that it would work in any kind of divorce. It's just, obviously, the amounts we're talking about are often significantly bigger than in an ordinary divorce.
Almost all of the ones that are slightly more acrimonious are the ones where the money was part of the driving force to get into court and get, like, particularly for Tessie and Louis, to get the best possible outcome. Because clearly, you know, whatever Tessie was originally offered, she didn't agree with. And then courts treat them like normal people, not like royals. So they just get what they would have got if they were just a normal Louis and Tessie who to have, you know, that much money.
Yeah.
So the next big topic that often comes up with divorce is housing and where the divorce parties are going to live. Because in normal people's lives, you have a couple who have often bought a house together or are renting a house together, and it's co-owned between them, and you have to find out who's going to live where. And then when you put royals into the mix, there's the slightly added dimension that some of them don't own their own houses because it's paid for by their parents or sometimes the government.
The elephant in the room, the York elephant, we'll call it. We have to address that because most couples, when they divorce, live apart. Because they don't want to be married to each other and they want to have their own lives. Now, Sarah Ferguson did for a while live outside of Andrew's house, but for a very long time, she has lived in the same house as Prince Andrew. So they don't count for any of this conversation because they're just weird.
Yeah, they're just like, yeah, we have divorced, but we love each other and want to live together.
So
fair
odd.
Enough, you do that.
Yeah. So let's just get that out of the way. But I think beyond that, actually, again, a lot of the arrangements are very similar to normal couples. They are not treated any differently just because they are royal. And I think, so oftentimes you'll have couples where they weren't working royals, they didn't have state funding, and they didn't live in royal properties. And so when they split up, obviously, they just handle it in the same way that any couple would be, which is, you know, maybe they, one of them moves out and gets their own house, or they sell the house that they bought together and they both buy new houses. And that's the way that any other couple would do it. So, you know, for example, Infanta Elena and Jamie, they lived in a property together and Jamie moved out.
Yes. And I think within that, you've got not a lot of cases, but there are a few cases where the couples live together in one of their kind of sort of, I don't say homeland because that sounds very dramatic, but will live in a country where one of them is from, and then when they get divorced, the other one goes back to their home country. So Princess Irene of the Netherlands or Princess Christina of the Netherlands both lived outside of the Netherlands when they were married. So Irene lived in Spain and Christina lived in America. And when they divorced, they both headed back to the Netherlands because that's where their family are, which I think is, again, a really normal thing to do. People will get married and moved somewhere together. And then if your family and friends aren't in that area during a divorce, you often tend to move back to where you were sort of originally from.
Yeah, it's so individual about, like, what's your individual circumstance, especially I think in the case of, like, Irene and Christina, because they were royals.
And also they had much more acrimonious divorces. They weren't, like, on friendly, amicable terms, whereas Alexandra and Joachim still get on very well today. So,
as you can see, it's sort of really dependent on the individual couples and their individual circumstances. And it's very, very similar to how any ordinary divorce would be handled, which includes the fact that there can be disputes about it. So Louis and Tessie, again, disputed kind of the arrangement for housing because I think Tessie was offered a house. They would say they would buy a house for her, but she didn't want that house. She wanted a different house. And she was asked to sign an NDA if in exchange for the house that they were going to buy her. And she was like, no, I don't want that. And so there can be disputes. And a lot of the time, it's in a lot of the circumstances with the two royals, as we've mentioned, they're kind of equal social standing, equal wealth, or even the non-royal is the wealthier one. There are occasions like with Louis and Tessie where Tessie was perhaps didn't come from a background of wealth in the way that Louis did. And so sometimes in those situations where the royals will step in and purchase the home. So it's like any couple who are divorcing, except from instead of maybe the husband buying a new house for the wife and the children to live in, it's Louis's parents stepping in to buy a house for Tessie and the children to live in. I think that most of the people in that category were people who, as I say, had private home housing arrangements anyway. When you get into couples where they were living in a publicly owned, state-owned home, they didn't have to pay rent, all of that kind of stuff, then you do have some who have like a new home purchased for them or get given the money to buy a new home, like Sarah Ferguson, as we mentioned earlier. But there are a small number who are allowed to remain living in royal property, sometimes the ones that they were living in before the separation, and sometimes a whole new one that sort of gets allocated for them.
I mean, the big one is Diana, who just really did just get the best deal of any divorcee ever.
Her and Alexandra are fighting it out, really.
It's just so lucky for them. Anyway, she was able to continue living in Kensington Palace after the divorce in the apartment she stayed in because that was William and Harry's home. As kind of mentioned earlier, she kept her office in St. James's Palace State Apartment so she could pop over there and do her work. And she stayed, she owned her Kensington Palace apartment right up until she died. She, that was her home. And you know, where Harry and William would pop home from Eton, they'd go back to Kensington Palace. And there was never any, she could have moved out because obviously she had a £17 million lump sum. She could have moved out at any point. But obviously also I think, you know, in one way it kept William and Harry very close to the Queen, to Charles, but it also gave the three of them a lot of protection because Kensington Palace is behind armed guards and closed doors. If Diana had moved out somewhere else, she would have just been kind of on her own out there.
Yes, so the other example that I found was Princess Muna of Jordan, who was given a new palace. She was given Humar Palace. I don't know if the name of that has changed because the articles I read called it Humar Palace, but they were from the time of the divorce, which was like the 70s or something, or the 80s. And I couldn't find any reference to Humar Palace anywhere else in like modern text. So I don't know if the name has changed or what, but I know that she was allowed to continue to live in a palace. I think that what you're hitting on there is really key because both Muna and Diana, they had security or had the ability to have a security. And so it was just much easier, I think, for them to live in a property, as you say, that already has armed guards, that already does security checks for everybody who's coming in and out. It, to a degree, it is just sort of common sense. I do think that, you know, when you're raising royal children, when you're entitled to state-funded security, it probably is just easier than having to like pay the cost of security assessing a random home that Diana wanted to build somewhere in Oxfordshire or you know wherever. And I think that I couldn't find any other examples of royals being able to stay in royal properties, and so I do wonder if it is sort of because of their position as mothers of future kings. I think, it, as I say, it's very similar to lots of divorces because they don't want children to be destitute when they're in the home of their primary caregiver or somebody who has them 50% of the time. This isn't necessarily what would happen in the future either. This was something that Diana and her lawyer discussed with Charles and his lawyer. So perhaps she said, this is my house and I want to stay here. And that's a non-negotiable. And so they went, right, okay, fine. Whereas somebody else down the line might go, I really don't want to stay living in a royal property. We don't have any kids together. So can you just buy me a house somewhere else? Or our kids are 17th in line to the throne. So can you just buy me, you know, and then that would be allowed. So it really is so dependent on the individual and their circumstances and what is best for them, best for any children, best for the family. Like it's often just a legal discussion and debate and negotiation in the way that it would be for any other couple.
Yes, it's a very I think fair way of doing it, and it makes a lot of sense that you know so much of housing in particular is caught up with children, and I think you know you can see from the ones who stay together or not together, but like nearby, are often the ones with much younger children. And as the children age, they move further and further apart.
So the last category we've got, I mean, we could have talked about this for ages because there's loads of different things, like, who gets to keep the tiaras? We thought that the last ca big category was kind of like the life that the royal ha the non-royal party or the divorced party has after divorce. Like, what do they do for money? What's their kind of public profile? How do people view them? That kind of thing. There are some examples of royal families where the spouse completely disappears from public view after a divorce. And these are very, very rare, I would say. But the main example that I had was Lala Salma from
Yes.
Morocco. Great. We're still on the same page.
No,
It's quite fun because I don't think we've mentioned Morocco so far in the podcast.
it's a brand new one.
So Lala Salma divorced the King of Morocco in 2018, and in the sort of 6 years since, obviously we had a couple of years with COVID, but in the 6 years since, we've only seen her sort of three or four times, and they've been like grainy mobile phone shots from across from some random person who spotted her in a crowd in a market or something like that. She's very, very rarely seen, to the point where they actually had to put out a statement at one point to say that she was safe, because there, at the time, there was a big discussion about the situation of the women in Dubai. You can go and listen to episode 17 for that. It was a very big talking point at the time, and so a lot of people were like, "Oh, well, we also haven't seen this other woman. What's going on with that? Maybe it's the same thing as what's happening in Dubai." Moroccan consorts have a very, very different role, and I think this is an episode in itself. But at one point in time, it was actually illegal to name the mother of the king. Actually, Salma being the wife of the king and having a public profile was extremely unusual because normally there were like no photographs of the consort of the monarch, often didn't even know her name. So not seeing her is actually a completely normal standard state of affairs for Morocco. Yeah, I would say generally speaking, royals do maintain some kind of public profile after divorce because they had one before the divorce, and your public profile doesn't just disappear overnight usually.
Yeah, and I think particularly because in the current era of celebrity media, people are nosy. Like every now and then, someone's going to be like, "Yeah, what happened to Jorge Guillermo from the ex-husband of Princess Christina of the Netherlands? What happened to him after all these years?" And it's like no one actually cares, but someone somewhere is sitting there digging up all the information on him. Be
Yeah.
like, "Great, this will be a good BuzzFeed article."
Like us who are doing it for our podcast.
Yeah, I was like, where are these people now? Who even are these people? What did they
I know.
do?
I was trying to find Jamie DeMaracalar's address on Google, and I was like, this is really weird.
They were definitely on a watch list somewhere going, these people are really stalking ex-royals.
Yeah. Oh dear. But yeah, so they still maintain a public profile, and I think it's very interesting to see what they do with that. Because if you think about it, especially the ones who are kind of working royals while they were married, they have been out of the traditional job market for often a decade or more. A lot of them, like in Diana's case, did not have a career before they married into the royal family. Diana worked in a nursery, and so they don't have a career to like fall back on. So suddenly they're in this situation where they don't really have a lot of skills, or they don't really have a lot of formal job experience, but they have this whole field of kind of career paths that opens up to them that they wouldn't have been able to do as working royals because they were considered to be unethical or, conflict of interest or whatever.
Yeah, I think, in our episode where we spoke about like royals in reality TV shows, and we spoke about whether like that was allowed and at what point that becomes too embarrassing for the royals. I think the moment you become an ex royal, a divorced royal, you suddenly have you have all the same opportunities as the kind of the minor royals, except A, you're more famous often, and B, you don't have the limitation of not wanting to embarrass someone. Because like, I'm thinking about when Mike Tyndall went on I'm a Celebrity. Like technically no one could have said no to him. He's not a working royal, but he is married to the royal family and probably doesn't want to upset them. So he probably was like, "Can I just do this, guys?" And they went, "Yeah, it's fine." Whereas someone like Diana or Sarah or Jamie, it doesn't matter to them if, Felipe's sitting there getting frustrated. He's like, "Nothing to do with me. You do what you like. I'm just fr a free man."
In fact, in some cases, it may be a bonus if they upset the former royal family that they were part of.
Wind them up a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And I would argue that all former royals pretty much use their jobs, use their royal connections for jobs to some degree. It's just sort of how they do it. So I have gone from the most serious to the least serious.
Fair enough.
So my most serious example is Alexandra.
Alexandra of Denmark. You just pops up a lot in this episode.
So Countess Alexandra married when she was 31, which is actually the same age I am. So, like, oh my goodness. And before her marriage, she was the deputy chief executive of a marketing company. So she'd done well. Like, I'm not a deputy chief executive of anything, but she wasn't Mark Zuckerberg. You know, she wasn't like trailblazing, internationally renowned for her ability at marketing. She was then a royal for a decade while she was married to Joachim. And so after the divorce, her primary occupation seems to be sitting on the boards of companies. And very famously, she was the director of a pharmaceutical company. Look at the board of directors of that company. They're people who have lots of pharmaceutical company experience or were CEOs of different companies. She was never at that level. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the pharmaceutical industry of Denmark will come and say, actually, she was a hugely amazing person to hire. But I kind of feel like she probably wouldn't have been offered the job of a directorship of a pharmaceutical company if she wasn't the person that she was.
Yes, she was always a very, I think, intelligent and clever woman, but she was not a pharmaceutical expert. She has no degrees in biochemistry, but she kind of she is, and I think we've said so many times, she's so well liked. I think she could have got any job she wanted. She could have been like, I think I will be a head chef, and I'm like, yes, of course, if you want to be one, you will be a brilliant head chef. So, I imagine it was probably, it's very good if on your board you have the ex-royal beloved woman who happens to be the mother of a prince. It's always a good person to just have around you.
There's not a huge anti-Alexandra campaign. I'd say she's probably more popular than her ex-husband, Joachim. And I wonder if part of that is because she has maintained a very serious profile. Like, when I think of Alexandra, I think of her as being like a serious, professional, competent person. Whether she is or not, I don't know. But that's how I perceive her because of the jobs that she's had since she's been divorced, because she hasn't really done anything like reality TV or anything like that.
Yeah, and even though she's remarried and redivorced, she it was a very kind of quiet remarriage and redivorce. Like they weren't on, a chat show every Friday night being like, oh yeah, this marriage is way better because I don't have to curtsy to my mother-in-law every time she walks in the room. She just did get remarried and redivorced and nothing else.
Yeah, and she's maintained a very good relationship with Joachim and Marie, and they've been seen sort of chatting to each other and hugging each other, and they seem to get on very, very well for divorced couples.
Yeah, she was invited to, like, was it Mary or Frederick's 50th birthday party, or Margarita's one of her anniversaries, and all those things are things that even though her sons were going, like, it wasn't a family affair. It wasn't her son's event. It was an ex-in-law's event.
Yeah. The second category I have called the pseudo royal.
The Diana
The
category.
Diana. Yes, Diana is the main example. So we know that Diana dropped about 100 patronages after she stopped being a working royal because she's had a lot of patronages because that was her job from, you know. But she maintained her public profile as being, you know, a campaigner, an activist, and she would regularly go like overseas on missions for different charities where she would be greeted by political leaders as if she was still married to Charles. And as we've hinted at a few times, Charles gave her money every year, which was specifically to go towards the running of her office. It was really her job, her role didn't change all that much. She was able to focus a bit more because she didn't have the public kind of expectation that she would have X number of patronages. She was able to focus her work a bit more. She was able to do slightly more controversial work. And the money that she got came from Charles instead of from the state. But other than that, her job didn't change that drastically.
I think when you think of the key Diana moments as her like charity work, almost all of them were from like 1997, like her landmine walk in that very not filled with landmine area, meeting people like Mother Teresa and Nelson Mandela. That was all post-divorce Diana, so just a normal, average, everyday woman technically doing these major things.
She essentially became like a professional patron. Yeah, and you do see that with like royal adjacents, I think, to a degree. Harry and Meghan are doing that. And I think that in terms of her public image, I think it's interesting because I think it was very Diana specific. Because I think, in you know, we've seen again with Harry and Meghan that there's a lot of criticism of this idea that they're trying to be royals in America with, but they don't actually have any royal weight anymore because they don't have a position in the royal family as such. Whereas I think because it was Diana, everyone was, you know, or the public was very supportive of her kind of being able to do charity work and you know, hug babies and all that sort of stuff. But there was criticism.
Yeah, I think there was this, there's always been this kind of long perpetuating rumor that I imagine probably is true, that around the time she died, there were lots of behind the scenes discussions going on about her getting a kind of parliamentary role, a
Yes,
kind of campaigner role, which would have been incredibly partisan, you know, incredibly linked to a political party. And I think Diana was in a weird way in one of the weirder situations because she was divorced, like there was no law about her not doing it. But she was also the mother of the future king, and you know, to many people across the world, was like the face of the new monarchy. So people applied the same rules to her that they applied to the actual royal family, even though she, at that point she was just, you know, a citizen who could do what she liked.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, we didn't really get to see very much of divorced Diana. You know, she was included at the odd thing in the last part of her life that was like related to William. We'll never know whether if she'd kept up her campaigning, would she have been sort of shunned by the royal family a little bit for being inappropriate? Would she have been kind of encouraged to temper her role a little bit and would have maybe found a different career or would have done things that were less controversial? You know, we'd never got the time to actually see what divorced Diana would have looked like in the long term. You know, maybe once the money, if she overspends loads of money, and you know, what does she do when she needs money? You know, and actually, that maybe leads us into our last category, which is the least professional and least serious category.
The Sarah
Sarah
Ferguson.
Ferguson. Yes. So, I mean, Sarah did make a lot less money than Diana, still more than enough for me to live on. I would have been able to just do whatever I want for the rest of my life. It would have been great, but not enough for Sarah, who was chronically in debt. So what she did was kind of a combination of the two up from above, because her job had like the showiness of the professional patron, but she's doing it for private companies. Just to rattle off a few things that she's done, she was a spokesperson for Weight Watchers. She released her own brand of tea. She did some exploitative documentaries about people on benefits. She, my favorite, she released erotic novels. So, you know, she's done a huge number of incredibly embarrassing things to make money.
Yeah, she, you know, it's when you kind of just try and like write them all out, and it's like pages and pages of like, yeah, she did some, you know, morning TV shows talking about sex scandals, and you know, did a infamous Oprah interview, as all good
That's all
girls
royalty, yeah.
do. Yeah, and you know, like she did do charity work. Like she's founded royal, you know, trust like the Sarah's Trust, the Ch Children in Crisis, which is a very big charity. But then at the same time, that's all completely overshadowed because she's doing that, and then she'll go on to this morning to talk about it. And what she's actually talking about is, yeah, you know, her best friend, ex-husband, Prince Andrew, and how wonderful he is all the time.
Yeah, and I think it's actually the most interesting category because it kind of plays into this conversation, which we've hinted at a little bit, and the conversations about sort of the royal adjacents, which hopefully we're going to have as a separate episode someday. But I guess my view is divorced royals, royal adjacents, people who are not in receipt of public funding are free to do whatever they want. As long as it's legal, they are free to do whatever they want. And that is the reality. People might not like it, but they are absolutely free to do whatever they want. And people might say, well, they're not qualified for these jobs that they're getting. And I think that's probably true in most cases. Like, what did Diana have that meant that she got to meet Mother Teresa other than the public profile of being Diana? However, so do the royals. Like, none of them are really qualified for any of the positions that they hold. They have them because they are state-funded representatives. Lots of public figures. You know, we've had the whole Nepo baby conversation in recent years. Like, there are tons and tons of public figures who got an opportunity that came their way because of somebody they're connected to, and they took it. And I can't really say that I blame them for that because I probably would do the same thing if somebody came along and was like, hey, do you want to write a book about how to host a party and we'll give you millions? Like, absolutely, I would.
All right, loads.
Yeah. But saying that, you have to recognize the fact that there can be very serious consequences if royals are kind of cut adrift, because they have, all of the authority and power and influence that comes from being a royal, but none of the obligations. And so, while I think it's completely fair, like there's nothing that anybody can do to legally stop Sarah Ferguson from having a business, but that doesn't mean that the royal family doesn't have to consider how what she might do. So we've got, you've got the funny examples of the things that Sarah Ferguson did to make money, like writing erotic novels, but you've also got the fact that she tried to get money in exchange for introducing somebody who was actually an undercover reporter to Prince Andrew. And it was kind of the cash for access scandal. So she said, if you give me money, I'll make an introduction for you to Prince Andrew. Or we know that during one of her many periods of debt, she had her debt wiped out by Jeffrey Epstein after he had been convicted. So she was somebody who was running charities or setting up charities that were meant to support children in crisis while accepting money from somebody who had been convicted of child sex offences.
And it's one of those things where, all the post-divorce royals that have carried on these really public lives have done good things, with their charity work. They've made positive choices. But there's no reason, Diana could have divorced Charles and set off on a campaign to, I don't know, promote Robert Mugabe. And she would have had all the acclaim and the status of being Diana, of being the ex-wife of Prince Charles, all her charisma that she had anyway. But, it wasn't, she could have used it for evil, but she could have promoted something that was harmful or dangerous or, and people, I think, she was charismatic and well liked to the point where lots of people would have just gone, well, if Diana says it's okay, then it must be. There wasn't in 1995 your easy access Google to check, her claims. You would have just seen what she said on TV, in the newspaper. So we kind of rely on these divorced royals to do the right thing, and luckily most of them have, or they've tried to do the right thing at the very least, with Sarah Ferguson being kind of a blip on the horizon. Whereas if they wanted to, they could very much be like, well, actually, you know what, I've actually really always secretly liked murder, I'm gonna go and promote murder.
Hasn't happened yet.
That could always happen at some point. That kind of risk comes with it.
But this is why, when I see Prince Andrew or Sarah Ferguson living in this beautiful home and getting invited to go to the Easter service with the royal family and walk in together, I can't even imagine how it feels to be somebody like Virginia who's made these accusations, and to see them getting sort of walking into the church alongside the royals. It is disgusting, and I totally understand why people get so angry about it. However, it is interpreted as being like, oh, well, they're accepted and supported, and the royal family love them, and they're sending a message to the world that they think that they support Prince Andrew or whatever. And I don't necessarily think that's true. I think it is part of this calculation of what's the risk. People like Sarah and people like Andrew, if they don't feel that they have enough money to support the lavish lifestyle that they have, if they feel that they've been cut off or unfairly treated, have a lack of morals, or a selfish motivation or something about them, or even a naivety, I think Sarah's quite naive, that I think would lead them to get themselves in sticky situations, which may backfire against the royals and damage the royal institution or embarrass the royal institution, and there is nothing that they can do to stop that. So the only thing that I think they can do is to make sure that they are sort of giving something to the royals so that they feel that they have just enough to kind of not feel like they have to go and embarrass the monarchy. I do think that them being included in things is less about endorsement of them and more about damage control.
Yeah, it's that whole kind of keep your, friends close, but your enemies closer camp, motto. You don't want to give someone the opportunity to destroy you if they have the ability to. And I think, royal divorcees, particularly people like Diana and Sarah and Alexandra, who were right in the heart of the monarchy. They're not, it's not like Autumn Phillips, who, was a sort of extra person. These three are key figures. They all probably knew an awful lot about inner sort of the dirty secrets of the monarchy, how the monarchy works, and there are thousands of people all over the world who would have paid handsomely for that, and they would have made a fortune and could have retired to live in the Bahamas. So if you're, you know, completely cut them off and, you know, exile them, that's probably what's going to happen, because they wouldn't still need money, and it's almost like that kind of revenge. Yep. Whereas if you are keeping them living in a nice house with money coming in, and you take them out for dinner every couple of weeks, they're less likely to turn around and bite you.
Yeah, definitely. And then you don't have to use sort of like, well, we know that Tessie was very upset because one of the things that the monarchy wanted her to do was to sign an NDA. Princess Diana spoke on Panorama specifically because she knew that there would probably be some sort of gagging clause in her divorce contract, and she wanted to get ahead of it. so she wanted to speak while she still felt she could. So, you know, I think sometimes people don't like NDAs. People don't like contracts that they feel silence things or silence people. That's, you know, I think even in the UK, people are a bit like, oh, when it comes to sort of injunctions and things that stop anybody from being able to talk about things. And so obviously in countries like the US, it's even more so because they have their whole, you know, freedom of speech thing. I think it is a way that, like, to kind of more softly stop people from embarrassing the institution, you try and make sure that they're not completely destitute.
And I think, you know, Sarah's an anomaly, I think, in a lot of these cases, but you can kind of trace the freedom that ex-divorcees have with their kind of popularity, because I went through a lot of divorces, and the ones where either the person is really popular, like Diana or Alexandra, or when they are fairly well liked by the family, like Jamie, they get, you know, kind of this freedom, they get a better deal, they can kind of go off and do what they like because they have that added protection of public support, or, you know, general, the palace is like, well, actually, no, you've not really done anything wrong, we'll support you. Like Ari Ben, he from Norway, he had a lot of palace kind of behind the scenes support and verbal declarations of love after he died, whereas people like obviously Iñaki from Spain, who was convicted criminal, people like Prince Carlos Hugo of Bourbon Parma, who married Irene of the Netherlands, Tessie Anthony, even people like Daniel, Princess Stephanie's ex-husband Daniel, the ones who aren't beloved by the public, who have annoyed the royal family, they are often the ones that you see pop up doing, you know, the Snyder interviews about how, you know, actually no one in the Monaco royal family is ever happy. Or and they tend to get less out of the divorce, and they then do the more negative things. So you can see there's a real correlation between the people who got the better divorces because they were well liked tend to just kind of carry on, whereas the ones who don't have public support, or you don't have the support of the monarchy, get cut adrift, and then often you see them come back in a few years angry and reacting to that, either by sort of defaming them in the press or by doing something that is embarrassing, even though they're not part of the family anymore. And I think Sarah's the anomaly because she's oddly well liked for a divorcee and someone who's done the things she's done. And I think I often see people talk about, oh yes, Sarah's there. I'm like, who are you? You know,
I think that with Sarah, it's gotten to a point where it's been for so long now that it's become like camp. Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes something is just bad taste, but then it's bad taste for long enough that it starts to become campy, and people are like, actually, I quite like that thing that's a bit bad taste. And, you know, it loses its sting a little bit and it starts to become kind of affectionately viewed. People have forgotten the cash for access and Jeffrey Epstein paying her off and all those sorts of things. And they're now just like, oh my gosh, this is such a weird, funny thing that she's doing. And look at, oh, Sarah.
Yeah, because she's such an anomaly because she shouldn't be well liked, and she is. And she's like a meme. All the others are real people. All the others are real people and they're treated accordingly. But yeah, I think, you know, if I was going to be a royal getting divorced, I would want to have the public on my side as soon as possible, because that's what's going to keep you kind of, they kind of have to keep you, to keep their popularity going, the royals then have to really look after you. Otherwise you just go and write a tell-all book and get a better deal out of that way.
Yeah.
So that is all we have got for this week. It was quite a long one, I feel like we did a very good job to keep it that short, in all honesty. We are still accepting questions for our 100th anniversary episode thing. And the cutoff date for questions is the last day of April, the 30th of April. That's when we're going to cut it, so we've got time to actually compile them into some kind of order. So you can send your questions by our SpeakPipe, which we keep adding the link to in various places.
Send us a voice note.
You can still send questions just by doing it in Tumblr or on Instagram. You can DM us. There's loads of ways. But for now, it is goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.